Amen. Well, happy Easter. Hi. I'm glad to finally be here. Easter is absolutely my favorite holiday, not just because I get to tell my corny joke of the year that I tell every year at Easter, but we all know that you go into the grave, you have one name, you come out, you get a different name, because you know, he went into the grave, Jesus, but he arose a victor. Yeah. Anyway, I get to tell my corny joke once a year, so I get to say it there. I tell other corny jokes the rest of the year. But I love Easter. It is our holiday. As much as we think about Christmas and as much as we love Christmas, Easter is by and far the holiday that matters as a church. And we are going to spend some time talking about Easter. But as a church, we have been in a series in the book of Joshua, and we are going to continue in the book of Joshua this morning. If you don't know where Joshua is, it is in the front half of the Bible. If you use one of the Bibles in the pew, it has an index. You can look, and it will tell you right on what page number Joshua is on, or you can just look up at the screen, because I'm going to put all the verses up on the screen. If you are here and you don't have a Bible, please feel free to take that pew Bible home with you. It is our gift to you. You may keep that. But we are going to be in Joshua, and we are going to be continuing the story, so let me get you caught up in case you haven't been with us through the rest of this series. By way of review, the book of Joshua begins when Moses dies. This would have been a tragic, a sad time for the nation of Israel. Moses had been their leader for 40-plus years, and at this point in the story, he has died. They don't even know where he's buried because God takes him up on a mountain, and he dies somewhere on that mountain. So they are without their leader for the first time. And the book of Joshua picks up as Joshua is actually going to be leading them into the land that God has promised them. This promise didn't start with Moses. This promise actually went all the way back to the book of Genesis. And in the book of Genesis, God promises a man named Abraham that his descendants, the nation of Israel, would be inheriting a specific land. And he gives them the boundaries of that and where the borders of that nation would be. And now, that's over 400 years later, they are finally standing right on the precipice of getting that land. They are just about to get the land that had been promised them, but they have this new leader who's going to lead them to that. His name is Joshua. And Joshua starts out just a little bit timid. It's actually fun to watch because he was the leader of their army. He was the general in the army. But then as he is called to step into this position of leadership over the nation where it's going to be on his shoulders, he's a little bit timid. And last week, what we saw was that God gave Joshua the command that he is to be bold. The words that God actually used in that chapter was that he should be strong and courageous because God was calling to him to do something that was really great. He was going to give them the land that was promised, and Joshua was to be their bold leader as they go to take that land. So that's where we're picking up this week, as we see them going to take the land for the first time. It says, and then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people. So what we see is they've been wandering the desert for 40 years. Moses has died. Joshua has taken over. Joshua is told to be bold and courageous, so he gets up. He wakes everybody else up, and he says, all right, here we go. We're setting out, and they come to an obstacle, the Jordan River. So if you don't know the geography of Israel, Israel exists in the west. The rest of the land where they have been wandering is to the east. Between the east and the west, on the north, you have the Sea of Galilee. This is where Jesus spent a lot of his ministry. But then from the Sea of Galilee, there is a river. The River Jordan runs all the way to the south to the Dead Sea. If you've ever looked at a map of Israel, it stands out really clearly. You've got the two seas with this river between them. This is the eastern border of what we now call Israel. So they're standing on the border, on this border, standing at the Jordan River, this major river, and they need to get to the other side. And most of the year, that's not a problem. Most of the year, the Jordan River actually runs fairly shallow. As long as you don't mind your knees getting wet, you can walk across the Jordan River, not a problem. Except during harvest time. During harvest time, it's the exact opposite. The Jordan River actually floods to the point that it overflows its bank. It rushes like crazy. And if you try to walk over during that period of time, you die. That's what happens if you try to cross the Jordan River during flood time. If you've ever been on the Mississippi during flood time. You'd know that. If you've ever seen even some of the rivers around here, after the summer, when we have a real winter, not like this last winter, but a real winter, and the snow melts, you see some of the way those rivers run. Well, imagine that, but like 10 times as big. You don't cross that river. So they have come to this natural barrier, and if they want to cross over into the land that God has promised them, they can't. Well, I mean, they can wait 6 months, and then they'll be able to, but if they want to do it today, not going to happen. It is an impossible, impenetrable barrier between them and the promised land. Except God didn't tell them to wait 6 months. He said, we're doing this now. So it says they camp out there for 3 days, and then the officers, those who are under Joshua, get up and they go start talking to the people of the camp. They start giving instructions to the people of the camp, and here's what they say. Look, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits, about 3,000 feet, 10 football fields, which, by the way, that's not in the original Hebrew. I added that so that we would understand how far 2,000 cubits is, about 10 football fields between the people of Israel and the ark that's out in front of them. That's how much they're going to say. So do not come near it, in order that you may know the way that you shall go. For you have not passed this way before. And there's a ton here, and I love it. It says, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. So this is a box, if you don't know Israel's history, that they constructed. It was a gold box, had two angels on the top, and in it they had placed a bowl of manna, reminding them how God had provided food for them while they were in the desert. Aaron's staff, which was basically a hunk of dead wood that God had caused to bloom blossoms from this dead stick of wood, showing that he was God, that was in there, and a copy of the Ten Commandments. Those were all in the Ark of the Covenant, and this ark, this box, was meant to be a symbol for them or a sign for them that their God was living with them. Everywhere this box went is where God went. When they saw the box, it was, okay, God is still here. And it's where when he was guiding them, he'd be a pillar of smoke, they'd follow that, a pillar of fire, they'd follow that. That was always where the ark was. So there, what he's saying is God is going to go before you. He's going to be carried by the Levitical priests. Why Levitical priests? Well, because they were the ones who knew the rules as to how the box was to be carried. There are stories in Scripture, if someone carries that incorrectly, they die. So it is very important that the ones who know how to carry it well, they're the ones who are carrying it. So what this is basically saying is God is going out in front of you. This is a good thing. This is something you should be excited about. But keep your distance. Let him go first. Let God go first, because he's going to show you where you should go, and don't come near it in order that you may know the way you should go, for you have not passed this way before. They are going somewhere new, which just to say that sounds small, but realize they have been wandering the same territory over and over and over again for 40 years. And yeah, the desert is a pretty big place. But no matter how big, after 40 years, they would have known most of the places they had gone before. The Adirondack Mountains are a pretty big place. But if you wandered the Adirondack Mountains for 40 years, you would probably know your way around. You would have seen that tree before. Because you spent 40 years wandering in the Adirondack Mountains. You know this territory. And what God's saying is, we're done with that. The 40 years is over. Now, we're going somewhere new. We're going somewhere you have never been before, and I am going to lead the way to show you that this is my plan for you. See, the Lord says to Joshua, so now God calls their leader aside, says, today, I will begin to exalt you in the sight of Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. So God calls Joshua aside and says, look, today's the day we're going to start. I am going to show these people that I am with you, the same way I was with Moses. And that's important because in just the next verse, we're going to see that Joshua makes a bit of a logical leap. It's because of that phrase. Because he's telling Joshua, I'm going to show them that I'm with you the same way that I showed them that I was with Moses. He's going to extrapolate the thing he says next. It says, and you command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan. He's saying, look, see that massive flowing water that would kill any man who dares set his foot in it, that would sweep your legs out from underneath you and carry you down with river and most likely bash your head against a rock? I want you to tell these guys to go stand in it. Go. Be bold, Joshua. Go tell them to stand in the deadly river. Go. Because I'm going with them. The same way that I was with Moses, I'm going to be with you. And I think Joshua's starting to get it because this is his response. It says, and Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So God tells Joshua, go have them stand in the river. Joshua says, got it. Figured this out. All right, people, here's what's going to happen. They're going to go stand in the river. And what God's going to do is he's going to divide the waters. How did he get that? Well, because when Moses had led them to the bank of an impenetrable, impossible barrier called the Red Sea, God had split the waters and they'd walked through on dry ground. And God said, I'm going to show them that I'm with you the same way that I showed them that I was with Moses 40 years ago. And Joshua goes, got it. Impenetrable barrier, water, we got to get to the other side. God's going to show them, like Moses, he's with me, here's what's going to happen. He's going to split the water. We're going to walk through on dry ground. All right, guys, go stand in the water. Everybody else, get ready because we're going through. This is what's going to happen. Joshua is finally starting to lead with boldness. He's finally starting to tell them, ah, God is with us. God has our back. God is going before us. We've got this too. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows its banks through the time of harvest, that's how we know what time of year it was, the waters coming down from above stood up and rose away in a heap very far away. At Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those waters flowing towards the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, what we now call the Dead Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Israel obeys. God shows up, and they cross flood time barrier, impossible barrier on dry ground. And for the first time in their history, the nation of Israel is occupying promised land territory because they had faith in the God who was with them. And it is at this point in the story, if you have been following along, the question that is probably forefront in your mind is, Pastor Kyle, what the heck does this have to do with Easter? This has nothing to do. There are no bunnies. There are no crucifixes. What in the world does this have to do with Easter? And I would tell you everything. Because the truth is, every single one of us at a different point in our life has faced an impossible barrier, something that we could not cross over, something that we could not overcome. And what happened that day 2,000 some years ago when Jesus rose from the dead, when Jesus came back to life after being crucified on a cross, was that he proved once and for all that there is now a path between God and you. Probably the thing that I hear most when I invite someone to church, or even when I hear about other people inviting someone to church, it's this phrase that we love to use, which is, you don't understand. If I came into your church, the church would burn down as soon as I stepped inside the front door. Anybody ever heard that phrase before? Anybody ever said that phrase before? We use that a lot when what we mean is, if you understood my past, if you understood where I'm coming from, if you understood what I did and how I've lived my life, you wouldn't want me in your church. That's the phrase we use to communicate that. And even if we don't use that phrase, oftentimes we believe that is true. We believe that if you knew who I really was, if you knew my heart, if you knew what I'd done, it is impossible that you would want me in your church. It is impossible that your God would want me. And the really cool thing about Easter is, you're wrong. And I love that. Because the reality is, what Scripture teaches us is entirely different. It teaches us that each and every one of us is equally broken. That there is no one in this building today who is more broken than you. But there is also no one in this building today who is less broken than you. We are all, in the eyes of God, in the sight of God, equally broken. We see that in Romans chapter 3, verse 23, where it says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Each and every one of us has come to a point where when we were measured up against the standard that God set, God said, you have to be this good, which, by the way, is perfect. So if you're not perfect, it means you have fallen short of that standard. You are not as good as you need to be to have a relationship with God. That applies to every single one of us equally. Scripture tells us that in order to fix that, in order to get across that barrier, which is impossible for us to do, the only way to do that is to have faith in God. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 say this, "By grace you have been saved through faith. It is not your own doing. It is a gift from God, not of works, so that no one may boast." In simple language, what that's telling us is God did the work. God has already done what is necessary for you to have a relationship with him in spite of your sin, in spite of the fact that we fall short, in spite of the fact that we are all broken. God did what was necessary for you to have a relationship with him. And the only thing he is asking you to do is trust him. Is to say, okay, I trust that you did that. It says, it's not a result of works, so that no one can boast. It's not a result of works because we couldn't do it. For us, it would have been just as easy to cross a flooded Jordan River. We could not get across. It was not something that we ever could have accomplished on our own. The only way we can do it is because God did it for us. And he's calling us to trust. And here's the coolest part. Everyone. And when God says everyone, God means everyone, which means you are part of everyone. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It does not matter where you're coming from. It doesn't even matter who you are today. If you call on the name of the Lord, you will be saved. He said, "No, Pastor Kyle, you don't know me." Again, this just shows you don't really know me. And maybe I don't, but God does. And he says this in Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 8, while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Not for the good ones, the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person, one might even dare to die. Maybe if you're a good person, someone might choose to die on your behalf. But God shows you his love. God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, while we were still broken, while we were not good enough to do it ourselves, that at that moment, that's when Christ died for you. That's the point that Christ died for me. not in ignorance of our sin, but because of it. He knew who you are. He knew who you would be. He knows everything about you. And while you were still a sinner, he died for you. See, it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter who you are. What matters is, are you going to place your trust, your faith in Jesus? The bad analogy is this. It's as if you and Jesus went out for a meal. You sat and you ate together all afternoon, all evening. You're all full up. You've eaten your appetizer. You've eaten your main course. You've even eaten dessert. And the bill comes. It's $250. No problem. That was a good enough meal. Your half's $125. Makes the math easy. You go to reach for your wallet. You don't have a wallet. It's gone. You left it at home. It's not here. One way or another, you don't have $125 to pay for this meal. The penalty is you're going to have to go to the kitchen and you're going to have to wash dishes. Problem is, they charge you just for being present. You earn $10 an hour. They charge you $11 an hour just to be in the restaurant. So you will never pay off your debt. You're going to wash dishes forever. And Jesus says to you, you know what? I'm going to pay your bill. I'll cover your $125 too. Bill is paid. The only thing you have to do is trust that your bill is paid, get up from the table, walk out grateful that your bill has been paid. The question is, will you trust that your debt has been paid and be grateful to the one who paid it? Or are you going to insist, no, I have to do this my way. I have to earn my own ways. I have to pull myself up by my own bootstraps, which means I don't want your money, Jesus. I'm going to go wash dishes. All the while burying yourself deeper and deeper in debt. When all you have to do is say, yeah, I trust that you paid it for me and that we're square. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. See, end of the day, the truth is this. God went out of his way to make a path for you. God went out of his way to do everything necessary that you, wherever you stand, whether you this is the first time you've ever heard this, or whether you heard this 80 years ago and you're just hearing it again, no matter where you're at, God is the one who made the path for you. All you have to do is accept it. So what? So what does this mean? What do we do with this today? Simply this. There is a path from where you are back to God. Whether you have followed him your whole life, and that's two steps to return and say, okay, God, I messed it up again. I did it again. Will you take me back? The answer is yes. Or whether you have been in open, defiant rebellion against God from the day you were born, and you have always said, I will not follow, but now you're at a point where you're like, actually, this God guy doesn't seem so bad. And if he was willing to do all this for me, I think I want to get to know him better. No matter where you are in your walk, there is a path from where you are back to God. And he did all the work that was necessary to make that happen. There's nothing you have to do but trust in him. But that means you are the one who has to make a decision. I can't make that decision for you. Nobody in this room can make that decision for you. It is your decision to say, yes, God, I will trust you. I will trust that you have made this right, and I will live a life that shows that I am grateful for what you have done for me. I want to follow you. Or, no, God, I'm not interested in that. I'm going to do this on my own. It is your choice to make. But you must decide. There is no way to continue in life from this point forward without making that decision. To decide to do nothing is to decide to do it your own way. Choose you this day who you're going to follow. Now, everything that I've ever said, someone else has said before me. Usually they say it better. So I went, and sure enough, there was a really fun video this week I found that I think, says this a different way, just in case you need to hear it again. I'm going to play it. At some point towards the end, the musicians are going to come back up on the stage. Guys, when the screen goes dark and says God, that's your cue to come back up. But would you consider what this means for you and what decision you want to make as a result?
So the other day I got a message on Facebook that said, John, I love the message of your videos, but not if it's coming from you. There are choices you've made in your past that render you not qualified to spread such a message. And for me, that was hard to hear, because the hypocritical Christian is something I fear. To be put in a category like that, I could think of nothing worse. So maybe there's something I should have said first. You see, I can't and won't and don't claim to be perfect. In fact, most times I'm not even good. I'll take responsibility for the mistakes I've made and the hurts I've caused. I got more than I probably should. But would God use that against me? Making good coming from my life impossible? Forgives me but refuses to use me? I don't believe in that gospel. I believe in the God of Moses. Moses was an orphan and a murderer with a stutter and a price on his head. Yet God chose this killer to be a fulfiller, performing miracles, leading his people, and making rivers flow red. I believe in the God of David. David, the shepherd boy who turned into a king, a terrible father and an adulterer from the start. Yet even with wrongdoings and iniquity, we remember him as the man after God's own heart. Mary Magdalene was a prostitute, living a life without direction. Matthew was a tax collector, the lowest of the low, yet they both walked and talked and witnessed Christ's perfection. Did God choose the Pharisees, the self-righteous and pompous, full of laws and pretension? Or did he choose cowardly Peter and persecuting Paul to spread the message of Christ's redemption? All these heroes in the Bible, not a one of them was likely. Leaning not on themselves, they leaned on God. And you know what God is? He is mighty. So can God use me? A broken, steaming mess? And can God use him or her or you? I'm here to tell you right now that the answer is yes. God can and will use anybody, even if you only go to church on Christmas. Does he only speak through the preacher? No, God is in a different business, because believing in the Lord isn't living a perfect Walgreens life, always doing right. It's letting his light shine from within and letting his word be your tutor. He'll take your broken past, helping you step into a more hopeful future, because it wasn't for perfection that Jesus died on that cross. It was for the unhealthy, so the sick could serve the sick and seek and save the lost. Because in the end, these words and these lights and these cameras and this video, it's not about me. It's about God. And with God, it's never about who you were, but about who you will be. It's God's story for the world, and we're just playing our parts. So if you're out there feeling not qualified, that's great. Because not qualified is where he starts.